You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 102.7 FM.
The huge run-up in food prices in the summer of 2008 created a worldwide food emergency. As a direct result of the crisis, an estimated 130 million people plunged deeper into poverty and hunger. Food riots erupted in countries all over the world, and the UN committed over $1 billion in food aid for the people hardest hit by the soaring food prices. There is now widespread consensus that the world is facing another food crisis. Food prices again are rising. They have been doing so for the last 8 months, and the food price index is now higher than it was at the height of the 2008 crisis. The question is, why? To explore that question, we've contacted economist Robert Polin. He is a professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's also founding co-director of its Political Economy Research Institute. He joins me on the phone. Hello and welcome to Red Eye, Robert.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First, could you describe the current situation with regards to rising food prices?
Well, I think you did a very good job introducing it. The key points, as you said, I mean, we had this global food emergency with the overall index in 2008 spiking by 43%, but with key commodities rising, doubling, wheat, for example, doubling. That was 2008. Now, prices never actually fell all the way back down to where they had come prior to the 2008 spike. So food prices remained, the overall index remained about 20% higher even when we got past the emergency. Now, but having said that, then, as you said, we're back up in another moment when prices are rising very, very rapidly. You have, the crucial wheat price up 95% over the last 6 months of 2010. We have corn up 53%. We have edible oils up 50%. So this is happening across the crucial areas. The overall index is up 43%. And this is, again, from a base. This is important. This is from a base that had already been high relative to, say, 3 years ago. So we have this terrible increase in prices. And as you also said, I mean, the people that get most directly affected, obviously, are people whose budgets are dominated by the price of food. So in developing countries, it's common for the price of spending on food to consume 50% of overall spending. So if you're the things you buy with food that is rising by 50%, that means your living standard is falling by somewhere in the range of 25%. And if you're already living on the edge, this pushes people over the edge.
If you were to put it in a nutshell, what is the most important reason we're seeing such a dramatic increase in food prices now?
Okay, you've disciplined me. In a nutshell, speculation on food prices.
What do you make of the argument, though, that it's not speculation, but it's rising global demand for food? There's just more people demanding more food that explains the food crisis.
Well, that one's an easy one to refute because it's simply not true. All you have to do is look at the data. Actually, the demand for food in India and China is actually lower on average by about 2%. Overall demand is lower. For example, corn, okay, as I said, the price went up 53%, but demand is flat. So that couldn't be the cause. It's just factually unsupportable.
Okay, well then let's go back to your notion of speculation in the commodities future market. Could you unpack that a little bit? What is a futures market and so on?
Okay, well, first I'll add the other argument out there is, problems with supply shortages. Well, there's two other arguments out there. One is the increased demand for biofuels. So that using agricultural products to produce so-called green energy. And that has played a role. So that's increased demand for not food consumption, but for energy consumption. There have been supply shocks. I mean, the Russian wheat supply is down. Production of corn fell globally. But these things are in the range of, you know, declines of in the range of 2-3%, which in terms of, you know, a global physical production of food, to have a decline of in the range of 2 or 3% is a significant decline. And for that matter, to have biofuels, you know, increase overall demand by 1 or 2%, which it does, is significant. But putting all those things together, these are incremental increases or declines in either supply and demand. They cannot explain these massive, massive swings in price. Now, the other thing that's happened in the global food market is, as you just said, is this emergence of this speculative market for food and oil and other commodities, just like we have massive speculative markets in stocks, bonds, options, and other derivative products. These commodities have become objects of speculation, or real estate, for that matter. You know, turning an asset like a home into a global speculative market occurred in real estate, and now it has occurred in food and energy. And so the food price and the market for food is now dominated by people who have absolutely no interest whatsoever in owning these supplies of food, but in speculating on the price going up. And if they come into the market with enough resources, they themselves can push the market up because they're much bigger as players in buying contracts than anybody else.
Hmm. Well, we did have historically, I understand, farmers tried to get some stability in terms of their marketing, and they'd make some contracts in the future. What's so different about this speculation from that effort?
Very good point. So there has always been a futures market in food. Somebody even told me that it might even be in the Bible, but I haven't looked it up. So the notion that farmers want to stabilize, their future, and so that essentially somebody comes in and creates a market. It's essentially a form of insurance for farmers. They say, well, I'll buy your crop now, even though the food, you know, the harvest isn't for 6 months, and I guarantee X price. Well, that's a very kind of very simple concept, and it's worked for thousands of years, more or less. Well, so the notion of having a futures market, that's what the futures market means, that we will establish and agree on a price for your future delivery of corn or wheat. That's what the futures market is. So that's been around forever, and farmers like it. Not all of them, but a very high proportion of them like it. Now, what has happened is that big Wall Street firms, always looking for new ways to develop big speculative markets and new ways to create assets that they can sell to their clients, have turned this futures market, this long-standing futures market, into another major object for speculation. So they come in with resources far beyond what the industry had previously been accustomed to, the futures market, the deals between farmers and these people essentially selling them insurance. So they come in and they take over the futures market. They buy up the contracts. And by buying up the contracts, then that gives them power to control the price. That gives them power to influence the whole mood in the market, which enables them to create speculative frenzies, which is exactly the kind of speculative frenzy we've seen in other markets. We saw it, of course, in the global real estate market, the subprime market, first of all. We saw it in the stock market, the dot-com bubble before that, earlier in the decade. And so commodities have become a new source of speculation by Wall Street firms.
Is there any groundwork that was laid to facilitate this speculation, or is it just the Wall Street guys getting together and saying, hey, that looks like a good new way to flip lots of money?
Well, very good question. No, the Wall Street people were facilitated by financial deregulation, in particular here in my country, in the U.S., where, I mean, we had basically two generations of a reasonably good system of regulations on the commodities futures market. We even have an institution called the Commodities Futures Trading Commission that was focused on this, because it is, obviously, the price of food is very, very important to a whole lot of people all over the world, farmers and consumers. So we had regulations. The regulations were essentially lifted in the late 90s and early 2000s due to pressure from the industry. And once the regulations were lifted, that's when we started to see this massive increase. And the market gained momentum over the course of the decade, such that one UN study found that the price increase starting in 2002, when we really start to have a free market in the commodities futures trading and speculation, found that the magnitude of the price increase and the volatility is actually unprecedented since they've been gathering statistics in 70 years. So it can't be a coincidence that this happens exactly when we allow the markets to operate freely without regulation.
So are new regulations or reinstated regulations a key factor for resolution of this problem?
Oh, absolutely. And this is the issue that is before us in the United States, and it's also being debated in Europe now. The regulations that were passed last summer in the United States, the so-called Dodd-Frank Financial Regulatory Reform Law, is pretty good in principle in laying out a new structure of regulations for the commodities futures market. For example, it requires that virtually all trading be done on exchanges as opposed to so-called over-the-counter trading. Over-the-counter trading is basically trading without regulation. So they have to be traded on exchanges, and there have to be so-called position limits, which a position limit just says that any one trader cannot buy up enough contracts that they dominate the market. That's the good news with the regulations. The bad news is they didn't get into any specifics. So, yes, the law says there must be, for example, position limits, but they didn't say what the position limits needed to be. They said that trading must be done on exchanges as opposed to free market over the counter. But they said, well, then there can be some exceptions. So what we need to fight out now is at the level of the regulatory agencies is how to specify these general principles, reasonably good general principles that were laid down in this new law.
So that's what we have to keep our eye on in the future.
Yeah, and it's very important that, because what the Wall Street traders and lobbyists have counted on is that, well, they didn't get a full victory when the law was passed in the U.S. Congress and President Obama signed it, and they were very frustrated. But they also, I think, calculated that there is enough wiggle room in the law as passed that once it gets down to the regulatory agencies, they can dominate the debate because nobody else is going to pay attention. So it's very important for people globally to pay careful attention to this and exert pressure. And as it is, some of the commissioners, the final decision makers in this body, this agency, Commodities Futures Trading Commission, are quite sympathetic around these issues and have pretty good positions. But if they, hear from 500 Wall Street lawyers and those are the only people trying to pressure them, then it's very difficult for them to sustain their position. So that's really the struggle that's going on right now.
Well, it's really helpful to have you identify sources and action points for us, and I appreciate you taking the time this morning, Robert.
Okay, well, thank you very much for having me on.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I've been speaking to Robert Polin. He's an economics professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and he's founding co-director of its Political Economy Research Institute.